So you just asked an interesting question about harvesting at the same time and to be able to get the same phenolics. Well, we've got the issue, how do you supply large amounts of plant material to go into manufacturing of these products and keep this kind of consistency? So I'm Janine Davis, I'm with NC State, and I work at a research station in the western part of the state and do a lot of work with medicinal herbs. And once I can find it down, there we go. So I'm sure you're all aware that we now have good manufacturing practices administered by the Food and Drug Administration for the dietary supplement industry. So this is for all the medicinal plant products that we make and sell in the United States. And of course, the goal is to make very safe and consistent products for the consumers to buy and use. One of the big components of the good manufacturing practices is identity testing. And this is on the manufacturer that they need to be able to prove that every ingredient used in their products is what they say it is. And this isn't up to the grower. This isn't up to the supplier, and this industry is often supplied by dealers or consolidators, basically, that collect material from all over and then supply it to a manufacturer. It's not on them to prove the identity, although we can use that as a marketing tool if we can supply it as growers, but it's up to that manufacturer to prove this. The FDA has not specified how a manufacturer must prove the identity of a product, and basically said use what is appropriate to that material, that natural product that you're using. So if you're getting whole plant material that you can clearly do a botanical identification, then just a grower providing a voucher specimen and you're looking at it, having someone with that botanical knowledge might be appropriate. But if you're buying something in a powder, then you're going to have to do some kind of chemical analysis or some other DNA analysis or something along that line. And sometimes there are questions about how appropriate the method that was used by a company to identify what was in those products or not. And most recently we had this all happen with the Attorney General in New York targeting some products and using DNA testing. So the manufacturers talk to me about how much they work to have consistency and composition of their products, and how we have gone so much to saying this product is consistent based on the concentration of a particular chemical compound within that product. So they might pick, you know, certain alkaloids or chicoric acid or whatever to say this is how we are standardizing. But they also tell me how much they need to blend materials because the products that they get are so varied. If they buy material from 10 different buyers or growers, I should say, you know, they could be very widely in the constituents in them and how they have to blend them. And they're like, we really need a more consistent supply. So the challenge is that raw materials are often sourced from growers in many different locations. This is necessary for them to, you know, protect themselves in case there's a crop failure in one place or another, that it is coming in from many different areas. But how does that affect the composition of their products? Where do the growers get their seeds or planting stock from? How can you be assured that they are really growing what you want them to be growing? How does the location, that environment that year affect the composition? And what about plant age? Many of the plants, the woodland botanicals that I work with, grow their perennials. And that golden seal could be 2 years old or it could be 20 years old. How does that affect the composition of those plants? So I'm going to use as a little example here a project that we recently finished up. We were working with Amway Neutralite. They funded this project. Supported a graduate student, Jennifer Crumley, who recently finished her degree, and I'll be presenting a lot of her data. And we looked at two species of echinacea. Amway Neutralite makes an echinacea product that they sell all over the world. They grow much of their material on their certified organic farm, Trout Lake, in Washington State, but they also source from other regions. So we looked at growing it in two locations. We looked at six different commercial seed sources, and then we looked at plants harvested after 1, 2, and 3 years of growth, Years ago, it was always talked about that Echinacea purpurea had to be at least 3 years old to be potent, but now we're questioning that. So in North Carolina, we looked at two locations, one in the southern mountains, that's Mills River, and one in the upper Piedmont, and that was Reidsville. We had very different soil types in those two locations. The experiment, we did separate experiments for the two species. So at each location were two experiments. For both of those, the main plots were the harvest year, so we grew it for one season, two, or three. I'm just going to present the first 2 years of growth. The subplots were seed sources. We had seeds from five commercial seed companies that could provide echinacea on commercial scale, so you could plant acres worth of. And the rest was seed, or the sixth one was seed saved from Trout Lake Farm, because they save their seed from year to year. And this was a nested split plot design. So we had different sources for the purpurea and for the angustifolia. And we did have great differences between the locations. So you can see on the bottom that was temperature. The Reidsville site in the Piedmont was always about 5 degrees warmer than in the southern mountains during the growing season. And then we had this incredible precipitation event. In the upper left, you see Mills River with that red line. We had record-breaking rains in 2013 in Mills River, where you could see in the middle of the season, you know, the rain was four times what we normally have. The whole year was over double. Angustifolia wasn't real pleased under those conditions, but this gave us a good idea of what could happen between different growing regions. Now, I'm not going to go through in real detail what we found here. I just want to point out a few things. Do we have a pointer? Just the cursor.
Okay.
Not that way. There it is. Okay. Thank you. So I just want to point out a few of these. So we did find that we had very much the seed source and where we grew affected various components within these plants. For example, let's look at chicoric acid in the leaves of the Echinacea purpurea, and you could see at Reidsville in 2013, we had more than double the amount of chicoric acid than we had in Mills River. And the rain didn't really affect the growth of the purpurea so very much. Looking at the alkamides in the roots, we had a significant site by source interaction in 2013, and we got our highest number and our lowest number in Reidsville, depending on what the source was that was used. Plant age did also affect our chicoric acid and our alkamides, and we had again a site by year interaction with Prairie Moon giving us the highest chicoric acids, Pharmacet the lowest. So then going on to what we saw with, went the wrong way, with the angustifolia. Now the angustifolia did not respond very well at all to all that heavy rain. We did lose a lot of plants and had to do some real creative work with our statistician on this. But what we found is that when we looked at the root alkamides, and in the angustifolia, we only work with the roots. We don't harvest the leaves. There's just not enough upper plant material to be worth harvesting. But what we found was our root alkamides were highest with this Native American seed, both in Mills River and in Reidsville, quite a bit higher. And this was really exciting. And in 2012, these plants were also huge. Thanks. Already. When we looked at plant age, which there was a significant interaction with site, year, and source, again, that Native American seed really stood out in terms of how much alkamides we had within that root material. So we were getting really excited. It's like, wow, we've got this rock star plant that we've got going here. Well, the first year, you don't get much flowers on angustifolia, and those plants look very similar. But as the season progressed in 2013, I'm like, these plants don't look quite the same as the rest. Now, it really didn't look quite this different. I mean, those were more pink. I'll show you this in the other picture. But we could see the differences in the rays, and I have a breeder on my staff who did breeding with Echinacea, and he goes, Janine, this isn't all just angustifolia. So we took samples and sent them in for a DNA analysis, and sure enough, it had pallida and angustifolia genetic material in there. So Amway Neutralite is, we can't use that plant. So even though the chemistry looked fantastic, the yields were really high, if they had created an angustifolia product with that, and it went onto the market and it was tested, say by the New York State Attorney General, they would have found pallida, which would have been made it considered contaminated or adulterated. So we did find, as we expected, that seed source, growing location, plant age, everything can affect the concentrations and the ratios of the phytochemicals in the leaf and root material. This is what, you know, we pretty much expected to find. This is a real issue. The one thing that we have come to a good conclusion is if a company is going to have material grown in many different areas, to at least be providing the same seed and to have that seed tested beforehand to ensure that it is the proper genus and species that they require. But future research needs to be done on this, particularly as we're sourcing material from wider and wider regions and as we expect more consistent products. We need to look at how all the basic horticultural practices affect these materials. Okay. We have time for a couple of questions.
Yes.